Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-led Forum and the Chair of this program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Alan Kaufman. Alan Kaufman is the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Jew Boy, the novel Matches, called an extraordinary war novel by David Mamet, and a book of poetry, Who Are We? He is the award-winning editor of several anthologies, the most recent of which, The Outlaw Bible of American Literature, was reviewed on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. Other volumes in Kaufman's Outlaw Anthology series are The Outlaw Bible of American Poetry and The Outlaw Bible of American Essays. His work has appeared in Salon, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, Partisan Review, Tikkun, and Tel Aviv Review, among other publications, as well as in many webzines, including Tattoo Jew, of which he is the editor. A former editor of Jewish Frontier, he is the founder and editor of the controversial magazine Davka, Jewish Cultural Revolution, and has performed extensively as a spoken word poet in the United States and internationally. Kaufman has been widely anthologized, most recently in Nothing Makes You Free, Writings from Descendants of Holocaust Survivors, W.W. Norton. A member of Penn American Center, he is also profiled in the Europa Biographical Reference Series. He holds American, French, and Israeli citizenship and lives in San Francisco. A lay ordained Zen practitioner, he is also one of the founders and dean of the Free University of San Francisco, which the New York Times recently compared to the freedom schools of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Kaufman's papers and manuscripts are on deposit in the Special Collections Library of the University of Delaware. Well established in his literary career, Kaufman is now gaining recognition as a painter of haunting portraits. And now Alan will tell us about Drunken Angel, a heartbreaking, honest story of triumph over addiction.
Well, thank you, Bill. That was a very thorough biography. And thank you so much for coming this evening. I understand that I'm sharing the club tonight with the CEO of Coca-Cola. So we're here both to speak about beverages. But I have a different kind. I have been clean and sober for 21 years. And that is not something that I've gone around in public forums as a writer, kind of explaining to people or announcing. And it never was my intention to write a second memoir. I had written a first memoir, Jew Boy, about being the son of a Holocaust survivor and how that impacted on my life. And so I figure one memoir is enough for most of us. But I had the good fortune to be included in an anthology about gratitude done by a woman named Nina Lesiewicz. And so I was on a panel at Corte Madero's Book Passage, the bookstore. And I spoke to, the fact that I'm clean and sober and how gratitude played a role in that. And afterwards, Brenda Knight, who's now the editor of Drunken Angel, and Felice Newman, the publisher of Clio's Press, both rushed up and said, you have to write a memoir about your recovery. So I was taken aback and flattered and terrified at the prospect, the idea of revisiting these places in public and revisiting them in prose. That would sit on a bookshelf. It was not initially welcoming to me. And I thought about it and procrastinated and asked other people in recovery what they thought, and everyone categorically said, we've been wondering when you're going to write such a book. You need to. So finally I set out to do it. And one of the things, the practice I have had in the past 21 years is whenever I'm in New York City, I'm originally from New York City, and a big part of this book takes place in New York City, is when I'm there, say, on book tour, I stop off at my hotel and throw down my bags, and I take this little walk, this little journey down to the East Village, where I ended up living in the streets in a park, Tompkins Square Park. And I take this little walk down there, and I stop off. It's a private tour. I stop off and look at doorways that I slept in. I look at manhole covers that I remember curling up on to keep warm. I look at the little alleys that I sat and drank in, and so forth. And it's my little private tour to remember. And I remember that person, you know, there huddled in the doorway, broken and unable to stop drinking and dying. So the fact that I stand before you alive and, you know, evidently thriving is something of a miracle to me. And I really should not really be here. And I kind of live with that knowledge that I shouldn't really be here. If life were fair, I'd be dead. And so Drunken Angel, which they gave me a contract to do and I finally agreed to do it, is kind of my walk back to the very beginning of my life to see how, you know, what happened. Like, how did I get to this place where I could not stop drinking, where I was dying? And then what happened? You know, what happened to change course? Because really I was, in a very real sense, like an airplane on fire falling out of the sky, all parts full, you know, kind of leaving the pilot dead in the cockpit. I should have crashed. And yet somehow, amazingly, the plane righted itself and the cockpit, the pilot came to life back in the cockpit, and the plane began to ascend. It's extraordinary that that happened. And it happened entirely due to the fact that of a couple of people who were there magically. One was a poet in a park, in that park, Tompkins Square Park, who himself was dying of alcoholism and of AIDS. And he was a well-known poet. And I knew when he said his name, I recognized him immediately. I knew immediately who he was, and I was amazed that he was in that park with me, drinking himself to death. And that night we shared a bottle under a ratty umbrella in the rain, and he told me his story and told me that he was dying of AIDS and dying of heroin addiction. And he was the first one to say, you know, you don't have to be here. You don't have to do this. He said, you don't even belong here in the streets. He says, you're not a street guy. You don't belong here. He was the first. And the second one was a graduate, fellow graduate student from Columbia University. We were both out of Columbia by now. We had both gone to the graduate writing program at Columbia. That's a lot of that I talked about in the book. His wife was in recovery. And so when I called him up, his wife got on. He brought his wife on the phone. She knew exactly what to do. And she took me to my first meeting, my first recovery meeting. And I stayed. A little light went on inside. I saw hope for the first time. It also, being in that meeting, addressed this excruciating sense of loneliness that I'd carried around with me my entire life, unanswerable by anything I did or tried to do. And I stayed, and that was 21 years ago, and when I had a week of recovery, I got on a Greyhound bus with money that I borrowed, and I came to San Francisco. And why I came to San Francisco is also kind of a mystery that I address in the book. Sort of like, why did I come to San Francisco? Well, it turned out that when I was a child, I had been here. My mother, who was a Holocaust survivor, in a desperate act to escape from the poverty that we lived in, my father was just kind of a Bronx street guy, his brother and my cousins, 11 of them, who were the only family you had, were heroin dealers and addicts and criminals. I have two cousins who died in prison. One was in there for murder, and the other for attempted murder. And a third who died in his mother's bathtub with a needle in his arm with heroin that his brother gave him. And so my mother kind of kept us very close to her, you know, apron strings, and kind of sheltered us and tried to protect us from that. And I was this pudgy little sensitive kid, loved books, and wanted nothing to do with any of that. I was terrified of all that. But the Bronx being what it was and that milieu being what it was, I had no choice at a certain point but to jump in some way with that life. So I was affected, but I didn't go to heroin. I went to alcohol. That was what I went to. And she, when we were children, kind of had this dream that my brother and I would be able to form a singing team, and would take us down to Times Square, to a singing school in Times Square. And afterwards, we would go to a shooting gallery, which was a place where they had amusements. And they had a little recording booth that you could record in. And my mother would have us stand in the recording booth and record songs that she would then send out to talent agents who were advertised in the back of these kind of lurid magazines, like stag magazines that my father read. And she actually got a response from one in Hollywood who said, yeah, bring them out and I'll get them an audition with Warner Brothers. The whole thing turned out to be a scam. So I wrote about that. And we ended up in San Francisco, living in a flop house as out-of-state indigents on Mission Street. And we left San Francisco in terrible disgrace. It was just horrible. And I think that when I got sober, the thought of coming to San Francisco, it just was so compelling. I was like, I have to go to San Francisco. I think the idea was to come back here and rescue that past, to make good on something that had failed somehow, you know. And so... Isn't it a strange story? You know, one of the things I found out about that place we used to go to in Times Square, it had a little museum in the back called Hubert's Museum and Flea Circus. It turns out the photographer, Diane Arbus, exactly at the time that my brother and I would go running back there to look at what was left, the remnants of the flea circus of Hubert's Museum, that Diane Arbus was also visiting that site. It's not inconceivable that at various points we were bumping into Diane Arbus, my brother and I, when we were little children down there, because we loved Hubert's Museum. And it was exactly the same time period. So just to give you a taste of the childhood aspect of things, and maybe I'll write a little bit. I'll read a little bit about the aftermath of the Hollywood fiasco. Because my brother and I, my mother, traveled from Los Angeles around the country for a while. She was really, you know, trying to escape from the Bronx. She didn't want us to go back there or to that life. By the way, it was mentioned that I have three citizenships, Israeli, American, and French. Well, the French citizenship I discovered I had when I was like in my 40s. I was in Paris and walking around, and I had so many relatives there, some who had died in the Holocaust. And I was wondering, what's my connection to this place? And my mother had passed away by then, and my father was very close-mouthed about everything. And so I looked through my mother's papers, documents, which I had, and I found this thing called the Livre de Famille, a family book, a French official document listing all the members of the family. And my brother and I were listed in there. So I went to the French consulate when I returned to San Francisco, and gave this to the consul and said, am I or am I not a French citizen? He looked and saw and said, yes, you and your brother are French citizens. When you were a year old, your mother went to the French consulate in New York and registered you with the French consulate. I said, really? That's fascinating. And he issued me on the spot a cartes de matriculation, to state that I'm a French citizen residing in San Francisco. I was kind of an alien here. And I called my father up, who was alive then, and said, did you know that Howie and I are French citizens? And he was outraged. He said, no, you are not French citizens. No, that's not true. I said, did you know that Mom went to the French consulate when we were a year old? He's like, she did not. That's not true. Never happened. You know, she was planning some kind of escape when we were a year old. And that's how we ended up, unwittingly, French citizens. Which explains why when we were 18, we received draft notices from the French army in the Bronx. I went to my mother, I said, Mom, what's this? And she said, nothing, tear it up, forget about it. It's nothing, it's a mistake, which we did, you know? Anyway, until Hollywood, Howie, my brother, had been a warm, talkative kid. After the agent's rejection, he rejected my brother and accepted me. He said that he would be able to do something with me. After the agent's rejection, he clammed up. I became Howie's emotional conduit, as if appointed to feel for both. I was mother's little genius, earmarked for escalating special treatment. Whenever she laid into me, physically, in the motel rooms, screeching, he stood by silently watching, half hidden by the doorway, sucking his thumb, big dark eyes grown wide with terror as I called out, Howie, help, make her stop. But what could he do, trapped and helpless as we were in her fury? Out there on the road when my father was nowhere about, she beat me mercilessly. This went on day after day in motels with names like the Sandman and the Costa Rica and Holiday Bungalow, muffled by the happy squealing clamor of families in bathing suits frolicking in the pool. My shrieks for help fell on deaf ears. Back in the Bronx, she woke me at late hours when Pop would be gone. And the harder I screamed, the louder she struck. No mercy shown once she was engaged. My only hope to play dead, stifle my cries. Though this always proved impossible as she managed to find that one spot in the elbow or knees which provoked more pain than I could bear. She caused me to break, plead, to no avail. With a shrieking sense of injury, at such times, I was not a self or a person, but a blinding blur kinesthetized by tears. My shadow on the ground or on a wall seemed more real than me. My mother bought the magazines too, these stag magazines that my father read. I read them when she was out. A shadow would grow in my thoughts. Desires so forbidden, their sheer weight crushed me. Turning 10 on the road, moving around from motel to flop house, I began to fear that I was a killer, one of those baby-faced, blue-eyed butchers portrayed in the magazines, gazing back from the dingy newsprint pages of my parents' magazines. I thought that if I was in fact a killer, I had best stay hidden from sight, especially from women, who I feared could at any moment unleash their rage on my exposed elbows. Life had once been a nice place to visit, but I didn't want to live here anymore. I felt everything too intensely, became twisted, writhing, a knot of fierce, furtive agony. Around women, I grew subdued, pitilessly shy. At school, could barely bring myself to speak. We moved from city to city, state to state, the perennial new kids on the block. When money ran out, we wound up in a San Francisco Mission Street flop. Out-of-state indigence. Soon after we arrived in the city, my father traveled there to join us. I suppose my parents missed each other, though I suspect she was in flight from the life he had made, which was no life. Naturally, he arrived penniless. Now there was no money and a fourth mouth to feed. To make ends meet, my mother worked as an au pair temp, and every night my father went out into the foggy streets to walk her home. They returned with a can of spaghetti and a bottle of orange soda, dinner for four. I remember this as a time of lice-crawling despair and sinister strangers. There was not even money for the stag magazines. I recall a couple named Joanne and Bob, young Linkhorn drifter types, descendants of poor Dust Bowl refugees who thought, same as us, to find paradise in California, who had befriended my parents and paid frequent visits to our squalid little room to find relief from their own dirty hole on the next floor up. Once, to prove how tough she was, Joanne threw me face down on the bed, thrust the knee into my back, and jerked my arm behind, twisted until I howled, but still didn't relent, even when I begged her to stop. "You little nothing," she said with a laugh. "Go on, kick and scream. It won't help you. Do it." My parents and her husband stood by guffawing. It was as if I was now in a stag magazine, stretched for sacrifice and torture. I swore then I'd never let that happen again. From there on, I must serve as my own shield and sword. So, you know, that was the beginning of the change in me. That violence and abuse, and when I came back to the Bronx, it didn't happen immediately, but a seed was planted. And when I we moved back to the Bronx, at first, Howie and I went through a terrible hard time. We were being picked on by a lot of scary people, and there was molestation involved. And but at a certain age, my body began to change, and I got big, and then I began to emulate my tormentors and determined to become worse than them. Like, if I was afraid of them, I was going to make them now really, really afraid of me. So let me just give you a little taste of that. Not too much. We don't want to get too much into that, but just to give you a sense of what that was like. Let's see. Here we are. Let's see. Excuse me here. I'm just looking for a particular passage in which I just give you a sense of what that was like. Okay. By age 15, after years, and there was a fellow named Billy the Barrel who was molesting me on a regular basis when I was around 12. By age 15, he was around 20. By age 15, after years of schoolyard training in gutter violence and sports, my body shut up, gained muscle, lost fat. I became a skilled, ruthless fighter who laughed at pain, relished blood, savored mayhem. Known around the hood, I prided myself on bruises and scabs. I grew my hair and sideburns long. My curled lip sneered, and my eyes grew sharp. Billy the Barrel still came around thinking I'd forgotten his enforced testicle holding. Saw me once and called out, "Hey, hey there, look who's gotten big, you punk. Get out of here." At stickball, with a bat wagging in his fists, cigarette dangling from his lips, he shut off his mouth at some scared kid whom he'd coerced into a game of pitching in. "Come on, you moron," he screeched at the kid. "Throw me something I can hit. Come on." When he spotted my approach, his face grew grave. He turned away from the pitch and the ball bounced off his arm as he tossed the cigarette aside to aim his bat at my forehead. "Come here," I said, smiling. He swung. The bat broke against my arm with a loud crack. I laughed. To this day, I can feel my hand clamped on his hair, slamming his head into cement studded with glass shards. Had a broken bottleneck going for his eye when hands from behind pulled me off. as others hauled him to his feet and hurried him away bawling, blood gushing through his fingers. Never saw him again. Other times they broke teeth. One guy's face exploded against my fist. Another with a knife out who picked on my brother got beat to a pulp outside a pizza joint against a car. Once this huge baboon named Fat Joe put out word on the street that he was gunning for me. I put word back that we should meet in a dead end off the concourse at such and such a time. He brought an entourage who stood silent witness as I turned his ape face into a swollen mask of blood. So that's the kind of guy I became. And, I just was determined from then on. I had a shield around me. Nobody was going to get past that shield. No one was ever going to sexually molest me ever again. No one was ever going to, abuse me, beat me, no one. And it got to a point where no one was going to look at me in a certain way. No one was going to say certain words to me ever that are going to cause me, to feel something uncomfortable. It became, walking around with a force field of intimidation. Now, in there, at the heart of that force field of intimidation, that cocoon of violence in which I sheathed myself, wrapped myself, was someone excruciatingly lonely. Someone who was really, couldn't reach out, couldn't touch you, couldn't be touched by you. And that feeling of loneliness had kind of accompanied me my entire life. And since childhood, I'd been that way. What happened was that, I went to college. I went on a football scholarship a promise of one to a university in Michigan. I was already had drinking and drug problems already seriously manifesting. And so that was over with. I came back to New York. I finished college in New York. And then, after bumming around in Manhattan for a while, I went to Israel. I woke up in Israel in a blackout and got to Israel, lived there for 7 years, served in the military there. So added to my skills and my defensive shield and came back in 1984 with severe PTSD. This was 2 years when I was there in the military during the time of the war in Lebanon. And served. And it was really, I had severe PTSD when I came back. And it was a very interesting predicament to be in. And very relevant to the times that we're in right now because I had no support services. I was an American who served in the Israeli army. There was no one to talk to about this, no one who could connect with that experience. I didn't know that I should even do that. And my response to it was drinking. Kind of was my only medicine, really. Alcohol was the only response I had. And today, of course, we have all these veterans coming back with PTSD, and I promise you that all of them are coming back with what I had. And many of them are probably responding to it with drugs and alcohol, So just to give you a sense of what that was like. Excuse me here. I've got so many pieces of paper here that can't figure out which is which. All right, here we are. Just to explain before this that I had a woman that I had an adulterous affair with in Jerusalem before when I left Israel, and she followed me to New York. I was in the East Village. I kind of crashed in the East Village, and I had an apartment there. This was during the rent strike in the East Village. That rent, the Broadway production, about that. That's about that, the East Village rent strike. So I was there during the rent strike, and then I got a letter saying that I was accepted to the graduate writing program at Columbia. I'd applied before going to up to Toronto. And so I got in, and I came back. I left the woman there. But, you know, I came back still with the PTSD stuff. So, and then I met in a blackout. I met a woman who I woke up in a flop house in the Upper West Side married to. She announced to me that I was her wife. She was my wife. And I had known her a week, evidently. We had been on a binge together, and we ended up married at City Hall. And I had a baby with that woman, a child named Isadora. You know, I loved Isadora. I really just adored her. And to me, she was like a beacon of light, of hope. You know, that I could somehow find some sanity and love in this world. So I swore off the hard stuff, just drinking beer here and there and going to the gym, you know, getting my act right, and had two offices in Manhattan on 5th and 7th Avenue, and had published a book with Doubleday, and was something of a little star at the graduate program at Columbia and all this. And one night, returning from work, after almost 2 months off the hard stuff, as I passed a high-end local tavern, I thought, I have done so well, have a beautiful daughter, I've published the book. Though I found myself married to a mad woman, I managed to provide my kid with a decent home. I've been off the hooch for some time, surely just one. Seated myself at the bar on a plush stool, took in the amber-colored luxuriance, and said to the clean-shaved, well-mannered, mole-like bartender in a red waistcoat and black bow tie, "Give me a Chivas Regal." And as he turned, in a flush of expansive mood, "Make that a double." Because, you know, we alcoholics are very expansive people. You know, a single shot becomes a double in no time. Held up the tumbler of caramel-colored whiskey against the warm, rosy light of an encased candle, inhaled its strong, virile aroma, knocked it back, warm, dilating my knots, imbuing me with an untrammeled sense of fresh starts, possibility and power. It shuddered through me. Another, why not? Which he brought, and I downed, and ordered one more, and then another. Heard thrashing, felt sharp stabs and scratches, balled up in hedges in a housing project in far western Chelsea, Manhattan, and with a post-nuclear apocalyptic aftermath hangover, came to my feet at roughly 4 o'clock in the morning. Should have known exactly when, but my Rolex was gone from my wrist, and so guessed by the feel of night, color of darkness, a world in which every last inhabitant seemed to have died, except me, shivering, sick, head split by white light, frenetic, high-pitched, screaming headache, nose swollen and mouth puffed, as if pounded on by mobs of fists and baseball bats, stomach struggling not to heave out both my lungs and liver. God Almighty, I groaned, standing up. Where am I? Realized. Looked around wildly for my leather satchel containing my wallet, valuables, take-home work. I staggered across town, pausing to lean against walls privately out of sight, closed eyes, stabilizing, and trudged on, nauseated, desperate to reach my Fifth Avenue office near the Flatiron Building, where I let myself in, found the bottle of unopened scotch that we kept for special visitors, dignitaries, and such, poured myself a tall glass, hands shaking. I downed it so fast that the liquor splashed my chin and shirt. Luckily, I always kept a fresh suit in my closet. I cleaned myself up so well that when the secretary came at her usual hour, 8 a.m., she found only Mr. Kaufman quietly poring over files, looking up with a cordial business smile, bidding her good morning. Another night soon after. Went out for sushi with Rick, a friend. Ordered warm sake with our food, several cups. At meal's end, I proposed that we adjourn across the street to a bar I'd spotted called Downtown Beirut 2. I can see why, said my friend, with your Israeli Army background, you might have interest in a dump like that. But I happen to know the place. It's a skinhead dive. I'd pass on it if I were you. I grinned. I'm going in. That's the PTSD right there. I'm going in. You and Eric Sharon, he said, well, good luck with that, and left. It was packed five deep with warlike skinheads wearing white-laced boots, Nazi supremacists. There must have been about 50 in there, tightly packed, and me, Jewish fundraiser in a sports jacket. But inside, coiled for violence, triggered to explode. Had noted of late when I drank the frequent appearance of a grenade-like blasting rage in my midriff, strapped on emotional plastique that boiled through my musculature, ached for detonation. The bar sold only warm beers, buck apiece, put away about 30. Looked at my new replacement watch, a cheap Rolex knockoff bought off a Jamaican street vendor on West Broadway. 2 a.m., the barmaid, a bottle brunette with Betty Page hair, dressed in low-cut sweater, tiny pleated scotch plaid skirt, and high-laced warlock boots, locked the doors, dumped coins into the jukebox, and as Mick and the Stones played Street Fighting Man, climbed onto the bar, pulled her blouse over her head, tossed it, undid her bra, tossed that, and with proud breasts jutting, did a strutting street fighting go-go war dance down the bar, kicking beer cans aside with her boots, arms raised above her head. The skinheads shouted and body slammed. Fists flew, blood spurted. Something struck my head, and as I turned to swing, hands from all sides laid hold. Went down in a volcano of kicking, stomping boots, though blind drunk knew this was cracking, as they call it, could result in a homicide. Came to my feet somehow, swung, connected. But too many fists replied, and down I went, too booze-numbed even to feel my own body. Was dragged out by my feet, dumped on the sidewalk, heard distant, enraged voices, felt the thud of more boots to ribs and back. Then someone said, kill him. And something hard-edge smashed my forehead. Insensate, yet I felt this was no ordinary blow. Bystanders screamed, he needs an ambulance. Hurry, please help someone call. A woman's voice leaned close out of the pandemonium. Hello, sir, can you hear me? We've called for help. You're safe now. Can you hear me? This bounced off consciousness, weightless. No, I muttered, no ambulance. What, sir? What's that? Another voice. Did you hear what he said? Crawling on hands and knees, I reached a lamppost and used it to find my feet. Concerned voice urged me to stop. Mentioned vast amounts of blood loss. Begged me to stay put. I could hear sirens in the distance and staggered away and escape down a street to a doorway, then another. Glancing back, wiping sticky blood from my face, I could see red and orange lights pulsing nearby. In the doorway, I slumped to the ground, huddled there. Darkness enshrouded, collar turned up, face hidden, hiding. Just make me a shadow. Oh, please, make me invisible now. And after a time, night buzzing and anonymous again, and gone the pulsing lights, the crowds closed over my near murder, I shuffled off. So, and that's when things were good. That's when I had a job and a home and a wife and a kid, and that's when things were going good. So, in short order, what happened is that one night I stopped going home, and I got a mistress, and I stopped going home. I hated my wife, and I would just go home to our apartment in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which I'd moved us into with lovely hardwood floors and a little garden in back. I would go home to drop off cash and then leave and go to drink in various bars or see my mistress. And one night I came home to do that. And as I was turning to leave, there was this patter of little feet on the hardwood floors. And I looked down, and there was my daughter, Isadora, now almost 2 years old, absolutely beautiful with big blue eyes, hugging my leg as if to plead with me not to go. Daddy, don't go. And I was amazed. I was astonished. I didn't know that she could articulate her feelings. I didn't know that she was ambulatory to that degree. I hadn't been around. You know, the alcoholic, just time just goes by. You don't know how much time has gone by, and you don't see what's going on around you. You're just somewhere else. I just didn't know that she could do all that. And, you know, I just adored her. And I picked her up and looked into those beautiful eyes and said, you know, your daddy loves you. And I kissed her and put her back to bed, and then I went to the bar because nothing stands between me and a drink. That's really what makes me an alcoholic. And, you know, it was at that point that my drinking took a turn way beyond this, into nightmare unimaginable, and I do write about that. Because I think something inside of me quit, gave up, ceased pretending that I was a father, that I was a writer, that I was a grad student, that I was a business person, that I was a husband, whatever. Ceased to wear all of these facades and was reduced to my essence, which is, I want to drink myself to death and get out of my face. Leave me alone. And, you know, I write about it in the book. Really, the best place to do that was the streets. I mean, I worked at an arrangement with my employers to get unemployment. And after a brief experiment living with some LSD dealers in north of Manhattan, I moved into the streets just so I can cash my check and drink with that check. And then, of course, that ran out. So, you know, it was at that point that I was in Tompkins Square Park. That was my regular stopping off place. And met that poet. And then was fished out of the park by the couple that I mentioned. And got to my first recovery meeting. And after a week with them of not drinking, I had audio hallucinations and I had visual hallucinations and I was, you know, I had the DTs and the shakes, but I also had enough self-respect even after just a week of recovery to not impose on these people anymore. I was sort of like, you know what, I'm not good. They were begging me to stay with them. He was a screenwriter for Spielberg at that time and she was pregnant. They were begging me to stay with them. And they had a big, beautiful brownstone in Brooklyn. And I said, no, I'm going to go to San Francisco and make my way. I don't know. It's the other end of the world, the other end of America. It's not here. I felt that New York had my blood on every street. And so I got on a Greyhound bus and came out here and started going to meetings and moving my hands and feet. And in recovery, you know, they'd encourage you to get what they call a sponsor, who is someone who will work the 12 steps with you, the 12 steps of recovery. And so I didn't do that. I was just going to the meetings and not drinking and, you know, and then, well, then one day in a meeting, a strange-looking man popped up before me like a jack-in-the-box and announced, "Ho, little brother, I'm your sponsor." "You are?" I said warily, inspecting the bizarre figure who stood before me, not altogether sure that I hadn't hallucinated him. Black, 5'4", if that, dressed in what I later learned was a West African shaman's cap, no shirt, a thick, ugly scar dividing him belly to chest, a cowhide vest, old suit pants held by a limp tongue belt, and heel-worn, color-scraped, blackish thrift shop dress shoes with frayed laces. On a nearby chair lay something that could only belong to this weirdo, a medicine drum with eagle feather tied to it. "I'm Carl Little Crow," he said. "Yes, little brother. And you, my new sponsee, are a newcomer to recovery, a new clean and sober baby." You know, I was a big, scary guy at that time. This is 21 years ago, and I was amazed at this guy. Others had advised me that I was going to meet some rather strange birds in the meetings, but this was too much. "And what is your name, little brother?" I wondered whether to say or not, yielded reluctantly, "Alan." His eyes widened in delight. "Yes, oh yes, Alans. I don't know any Alans." A smile crept over my lips. clearly he was harmless. Had a face that crossed Mount Rushmore with the chipmunk, a strange broad-nosed face with velvet black eyes and a curious dignity that I couldn't quite place, had never seen before, kind of inherent royal defiance. Whatever else he was no phony. I felt that. Odd, yes. Another's puppet? No. If I couldn't figure out what exactly he was, still, he was like no one else I'd ever met. Let me take you to coffee, he offered. Sure, I said, having all of 8 cents to my name. We went to All You Need on Haight Street. A lot of the recovering drunks and addicts seemed to hang out there. Settling into a booth, we each ordered the $1.99 breakfast of scrambled eggs, home fries, toast, and all the coffee you could drink. He asked where I was from, how much sober time I had. When I told him less than a month, he was overjoyed. You're the most important person in the meetings, he said. Why is that? Because, little brother, you are closer to the last drink than us. We have a tendency to forget. You'll remind us. How long have you been sober? 18 years. He bristled with a fierce, happy energy that I'd never seen before in anyone in my entire experience. I asked what was involved in sponsorship. Gently, slowly, little brother, one day at a time, we walk through sobriety together. My heart sank. Does that mean I have to see you every day? He laughed, clapped his hands in glee, happy as a child. No, oh no, little brother, no. We just meet once in a while to work the steps. If you get into trouble, call me. Have a question? I'll answer if I can. Feel frightened? Call me. Think you'll drink? Before you do, let's talk. And between our get-togethers, go to meetings as many as you can and don't drink one day at a time, no matter what. Isn't that simple? It wasn't as if I had better options. And anyway, I was in California, land of the weird. Carl Little Crow fit right in with my sense of the left coast. I'd never met or seen anyone like him, a cross between Cochise and Ratso Rizzo. Sure, I said, okay, you're my sponsor, as if I were doing him a big favor. Breakfast came. We dug in. I learned that he was not from here. A back-alley gutter drunk from Chicago, he had come west with a recovery poet buddy named Fritz, otherwise known as Redman. He asked me to tell him exactly what was going on in my life currently. I explained about losing my little girl Isadora, how he ended up heartbroken, lost in Tompkins Square Park, not caring anymore if I died, and how Jim Brody, the poet, told me to save myself. And next I knew, Philip led me to Jackie, who 12-stepped me into my first meeting. I told about Bernadette and Brick and where I now lived and what I was doing, described the voices that spoke to me as I walked around on Haight Street, the glaring, lantern-eyed, toothless, and tattooed devils that followed me, and what horrors I felt lay in store for me. I told them that right at that moment, there were operatives of several intelligence agencies undertaking surveillance of my every move. They were outside the restaurant. In all likelihood, our conversation was being recorded. I asked him what he thought of that. Wonderful, he exclaimed, clapping his hands. And yet you're staying sober. Why would you if you're so sure that you'll meet a terrible end? I didn't know how to answer that. Part of you, he said, suspects it's not true, even though it seems so real. That part of you is the part that wants to live. The Great Spirit is watching over you. You're immune. It feels damned real to me when it's happening, I said. But do you think it's real? Part of me does. He nearly jumped out of his seat. In other booths, people looked around. Ho, he cried. Then you think that you are crazy? Yeah, I do. Good, wonderful, because, little brother, you are crazy. And so what choice do you have but to enjoy it? Stop fighting how crazy you are. All your suffering comes from trying to pretend that you are sane. I knew he was right. I began to laugh from deep down with relief. So tell me, Carl Little Crow, let's say you're right. It's all delusion. Then what's real? Sobriety is real, and the breath. The rest is mental, conjectural sleight of hand. Great Spirit is in the breath. The great reality is deep within, and the way in is through the breath. You breathe involuntarily despite yourself. It breathes you without your permission. It doesn't need your cooperation. You are helpless not to breathe. If breath is cut off, you will do all you can to find air. Breath is the source of your life. Breath is the gateway to the Great Spirit. Thank you very much. So do we have any questions or comments or... Please.
I was just wondering, with all this experience that you've had, do you ever counsel other people or consider doing that?
I do. I work with other alcoholics on a daily basis, actually. It's a big part of my life. Yeah.
First of all, just thank you so much for your story and the courage to... stand up here for an hour and share that kind of stuff with all of us. So just thank you for that. And I'm kind of curious, how long were you on the street?
Not that long. It was about 6 months. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, about 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, and kind of during the time you were out here in California, kind of this gypsy lifestyle, it sounded like the adventure with the Hollywood thing, you still had the wherewithal to apply to college. Can you kind of... How did you manage all that and getting into such a prestigious school and sort of maintaining that sense of self to get through that?
Yeah, well, the City College of New York that I went to, it was the first year of open admissions. So basically to get in, all you had to have is two arms and two legs and a head, and they took you in. It was an excellent school, by the way. They called it the Harvard of the Proletariat. It was $58 a semester. It was a great school. Studied with some great people there. Graduate school, I had done some writing and published a few short stories here and there, and so I submitted those to Columbia with my application, and evidently they felt it was of sufficient promise to take me in, and so they did. That's how. But I turned that into... I just completely wrecked that. I mean, you can read all the gory details in the book. It's...
What are you doing now professionally? Are you writing more? Or?
I write. I teach. I also paint. I make something of a living as that as well. But writing, teaching, painting, and the Free University of San Francisco, which I'm on a brief hiatus from because of this book tour thing, but we'll be going back to in February. So that's kind of constitutes my main activities. Please.
Oh, it does. Oh, bummer.
You can do it.
Yeah, I know. I can do it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very, very much for sharing that. That's great. How long did it take you to put this all in writing for this book?
It took, I like to think, you know, I'm now 59 and a half years old, so it took me 59 and a half years.
Yeah.
But the actual writing itself, I'm sure it was always going on somewhere. The actual writing of the book altogether from start to finish was maybe a year. Yeah.
A year. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And are you here in San Francisco?
Yes.
You're local?
I am. I'm local.
So what's a Stag magazine?
You know, I'm sure they still exist, but back in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up, when I was a kid, they were these lurid magazines. And it's really, there's a lot of like sociological studies have been done about them. A lot of them would just portray Nazis torturing beautiful women in this kind of sexual way, and the women seemed to be enjoying it, and there would be like swastikas and perspiring breaths and guys and, you know, with their shirts off doing horrible things. And in them would also be pictures and articles about like horrible killers, you know, and just, they were just lurid magazines. And my father read that stuff like on a regular basis. That was my first introduction to literature. And my mother would read them too. There was some kind of weird thing going on there. Erotica mixed with, you know, Nazi fetish S&M and, you know, kind of the criminal subculture. It was all in there, you know. And that was my first reading matter, was that stuff. Yeah. So those were the Stags. Stag magazines. I write about that in and Drunken Angel in more detail.
Do you have any connection with any of your family now, or are they all gone? Or?
Oh, yes. Part of my recovery was to reconnect with my daughter. I had to make amends to all these people. I sought people out that I had, you know, physically hurt when I was growing up. I sought people out that I, you know, everyone I could find to, you know, approach and say, you know, what I had done was wrong. And, you know, I'm here to make amends. I did all kinds of things. I contacted Lincoln Center because I had once punched out a security guard at Lincoln Center. And I called up Lincoln Center when I was about 8 years sober and said, here I am. And, you know, in this year, years ago, I assaulted a security guard, and I'm here to turn myself in and face whatever consequences were involved. And there was a long pause. I was talking to the security office, and this guy said, why are you doing this? I said, well, I'm clean and sober, and I have to do this to stay clean and sober, to make amends. And after another long pause, he said, you know, that's really great. Look, forget about it, okay? We don't know what happened 20 years ago here, you know. So, yeah. But I tried, you know. And part of that was my daughter, to make amends when she was 9 and I was 6 years sober. They moved to another country. I made amends to my ex-wife and especially to my daughter, promising to be in her life to the best of my ability, because she lives abroad, as much as I could be, and I have been to the best of my ability in her life ever since. She calls me daddy, and, you know, so, yeah. And I write a lot about that in the book, about that. And also, you know, something else that happened is she came out to me as gay when she was 19. She called me and said, there's something really important I have to tell you. And I flew out to Tel Aviv, she's in Tel Aviv, to see her. And she said, Daddy, I'm terrified to tell you this. I said, well, what is it? She said, I'm gay. I was like, oh, I breathed relief because I knew it was. I said, well, that's great. I'm in San Francisco. Perfect. You know, how wonderful. You know, I was really pleased. It wasn't like I have a fatal illness or something, you know, something good. You know, I said, you know, I'm very actually jealous. I wish I wasn't hetero. I'm so bored with it. You know, gays seem to have great fun. So, you know, I made amends for her and I gave her that ability to, you know, come out and be who she really is. That's a big part of recovery, is to be true to who you really are and find out who that is and be it. Yeah. So.
All right. Our thanks to Alan Kaufman for his reading of his book this evening. And now this meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.